Amen. All right. Well, I do want to add my warm welcome to all of you as we begin this workshop. If you've been here in past years, you know you're about to embark on a rich weekend of growth as Bible students and teachers. And if this is new to you, you are right to expect some good times of fellowship around the Word. But you might already be a bit surprised and even a little overwhelmed by the amount of effort and focus it takes just to get ready for your Women in the Word experience. So we do want to stretch you, but not overly stress you. So my little talk is intended to give you some of the mental furniture that you're going to need to take you through this weekend and understand kind of what's going on. Because one of the main things we would like you to take away is this idea that the Bible tells one coherent story from beginning to end, from Genesis through Revelation. And it's a story that's often goes by the name of redemptive history. It's history in that it marches through time. So we'll be using a timeline to keep track of where we are. And then it's redemptive in that it tells a story of redemption or God's plan to save a people for himself. So redemptive history is what we're up to this weekend. And it wouldn't be surprising if some of you found this a new way of thinking about the Bible, a new way of reading the Bible, because in our churches, Bible stories and passages are tend to be taught as standalones with no attempt to connect them or put them in any sort of an order. So your knowledge of the Bible right now may just be a jumble of favorite passages and famous stories and a psalm or two, but you may not know the flow of the whole big picture story. So that's what I'm here to help you get to know a little bit, to at least increase your awareness of the biblical timeline, so you'll be able to make better sense of what we do at the workshop this weekend. Of course, a lot of you are already familiar with at least the broad outlines, if not the little details, but you may not have ever considered it from the angle that I'm going to present. So hopefully this idea that I have for you is going to be intriguing, even as the talk is just a refresher as we walk through the different stages of the biblical plot line. You do have in your folders, if you haven't pulled it out yet, a copy of this timeline that you can use for future reference. And on the back of it, there's space for taking notes if you want to jot something down. This talk will be recorded and posted online eventually if you want to hear it again. So our task today is to trace a particular theme through the Bible, not merely to see how it's treated by the different biblical writers, but also to discover how the theme develops over time through the centuries of biblical revelation. Because in a way, the Bible is like a good mystery novel. There are hints sprinkled throughout of what God is going to do about the mess the world is in. And those hints gradually build up a portrait of someone who is coming to set everything to rights. And of course, we're reading it from the perspective of the end of the story, so we know how it all turns out. We know who the hero is and what he had to do to save us. But as we read in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, we might well wonder, what did the first readers or hearers think about these hints? What did they already know? And how do the early hints link with the later ones? And then how does our hero Jesus demonstrate God's faithfulness to finish what God started? So we're going to dive in and find out as we talk about the scepter of righteousness today. And I'm going to start with something from the end of the mystery novel. This is not technically a spoiler because, like I said, we're reading with our post-resurrection spectacles on. We already know how it turns out. But here's something from our New Testament book of Hebrews, which is itself a feast of redemptive historical writing. That means that the writer of Hebrews really liked to use the Old Testament to make his points. One of the arguments that the author of this letter makes early on is that Jesus is superior to the angels. Since he's not merely God's servant, he's also God's son. So in chapter 1, the author launches into this laundry list of Old Testament quotations that demonstrate this point that Jesus is superior. In other words, this writer is assuming that the Hebrew texts give him some information about Jesus. And here's one of the passages he quotes. It's from Psalm 45. But of the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions." So again, this New Testament writer is using this Old Testament text because he thinks it tells him something about Jesus, that Jesus is the Son of God and equal with God and an anointed, reigning, and righteous king. And what's intriguing is that that information was available to the readers in Old Testament times through this psalm. And that might make us wonder, what did the original readers of Psalm 45 understand about the promised one who was coming to set the world right? And that's the kind of question we're going to keep in mind as we talk about this idea of the scepter and kingship and follow it through the timeline of the biblical story. Well, let's talk about scepters a minute. I just read to you from Hebrews about the scepter of righteousness. Now, I know we haven't been ruled by a king since 1776 here in this country, so you probably haven't thought much about scepters recently or who uses them or what they're for or how long they've been around. But if I asked you, if we were playing Pictionary and I asked you to draw a picture of a king or a queen, there's a couple things you would put in your sketch, and a scepter might be one of them, even if you don't know what it's for. Here's an illustration from British history. Doubtless you'd draw a crown on your monarch, and that might be enough for Pictionary, right? But if you kept going, you might also add the stick, that's the scepter, and the ball, that's the orb. And the orb and the scepter are symbols of power and dominion. The orb means this guy rules over the whole world, or at least he wants to, and the scepter means he can control his domain however he wants. So England's crown jewels are probably the main sources of our modern mental image of the scepter, but this symbol has been around from ancient times. So this made it an appropriate and familiar idea to use for whenever the biblical writers wanted to convey something about royal power and authority. In the scriptures, the word is usually used figuratively. You're just supposed to imagine a scepter. But sometimes an actual physical scepter was involved, like here. We'll mention this story again when we get into the timeline. It comes along kind of later. But probably the most famous biblical scepter is the one that caused such anxiety in Esther's story. And as she put it to her cousin Mordecai, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, so he may live." So here, this act of holding out the scepter, it speaks a whole symbolic sentence. The king is saying, "I extend my power to save your life." And of course, he has the power to destroy lives as well. So keep in mind this combination of mercy on the one hand and judgment on the other as we talk about the scepter that symbolizes Jesus' righteous reign. So we're going to turn to the biblical timeline now and follow this image of the scepter and this notion of kingship through the story of redemptive history. It's going to be a quick overview, necessarily. So if this is new to you, your main takeaway is just this is something important to pay attention to, especially this weekend, and then you can learn more about it in the future. I'll share some ideas for how you can do that at the end of this talk. So just glancing at this timeline, you can see from the categories that I have here that redemptive history, this history that's presented in the Bible, it's primarily concerned with the nation of Israel. Not entirely so. It's also a story that's as big as all of humanity, but primarily, that's the case. It's mainly about Israel. So notice, where do the kings enter the picture, scepters and all? Israel's first kings actually don't show up until around the middle of the story, and they don't last for long. So we can divide this timeline into three parts. There's the time leading up to Israel's monarchy, and during the monarchy, and then afterwards. Relatively speaking, Israel's kings really weren't around for much of it. But we're going to see that even though the political situation kept changing for Israel, there was one steady scepter in play. At first, it was just in their imaginations, hopes, and dreams. But from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, that's our scepter of righteousness that we heard about in Hebrews. So, now for a chronological tour of kingship through the timeline of biblical history. We can actually begin in the very beginning, because even though Israel wasn't even a nation at that time, there's kingship built into the story from the very start. And as we go, I'm going to be keeping a list up here on the overheads of the characteristics of the king that's been being anticipated. It'll be a visual reminder of this progressive portrait that develops over the centuries of Revelation. So theologians call the first 11 chapters of Genesis primeval history. And that's because this section is concerned with events that happened before the dawn of time on planet Earth. And God's own sovereignty, his kingship over creation, is established from the first words recorded by Moses. In the beginning, God created. And sometime later, with the command to take dominion over the created world, God gives the authority to rule to his representatives, male and female, made in his image. So figuratively speaking, the Lord God hands his scepter of righteousness to the human monarchs of creation. And of course, the rule of human beings is almost immediately interrupted and corrupted by their act of disobedience, which we read about in Genesis 3. But I can convey to you that even though their reign, their dominion, was spoiled practically from their coronation ceremony, God's sovereign plan for righteous rule was never thwarted. In his words to the serpent after the fall, God describes a future scene in which a victorious warrior will crush the enemy of humankind. And this is what he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So right from the get-go, readers of Genesis are instructed to look to the future. And what are they supposed to anticipate? Well, a son of humanity is coming, whose power and goodness will deal a mortal blow to the ancient enemy, Satan. And this warrior will display the traits of a true king. He'll be righteous and capable of a fight against a mighty enemy and victorious. So the seed of hope is planted right at the beginning of the story that someone is coming who will wield that scepter of righteousness. We fast forward now to the call of Abraham in Genesis 12. And this is where the story narrows from the scope of all of humanity down to focus on one man and his extended family. And we call the rest of Genesis the account of the patriarchs. So that would be Abraham, his son, his grandson, and all his great-grands. And we don't yet see any kings in these early days of the nation of Israel, but we do hear about them in the words of promise and blessing. I know you know God's promises to Abraham, the land and a son and many descendants, and that all the families of the earth would be blessed through him. But there's one little detail from those promises that may never have registered with you, because God also says this, "I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you." And what must that promise have felt like to that nomadic herder with no children and not even any land yet on which to build a house, let alone a royal palace? And it would be still many distant generations before actual kings came into the picture for Israel. Meanwhile, they only knew the kings of other nations around them. But this expectation of kingship, looking forward to a monarchy, that was the mental set of Israel from the beginning of their history. Now, at the end of Genesis, we watch the drama of Joseph's life unfold. And here we see an account of a king, up close and personal, as Joseph interacts with the royal leader of Egypt. And just like Esther's encounter with a foreign king much later in biblical history, Joseph learns firsthand about the power and authority symbolized by Pharaoh's royal scepter as the king of Egypt dispenses his judgment and his mercy on Joseph's prison acquaintances. And in fact, when some of Pharaoh's power and authority is later conferred on Joseph himself, he learns directly what it means to exercise both judgment and mercy like a king. In his cat and mouse treatment of his brothers, we glimpse the terror that a king can wield over his suppliants, as well as the vastness of his mercy when he chooses to grant it. And maybe you're already aware of how much Old Testament Joseph prefigures Jesus, especially in his unjust sufferings and his later rise to power for the salvation of many. But maybe you've never thought of the kingly prerogatives that Joseph exercised there in Egypt. That also prefigures the later kingly activity of the risen Jesus. Both have the power to condemn and to pardon. Both are motivated by justice and mercy as they carry out God's will. So Pharaoh's Egypt is the setting for some words we hear from Joseph's father Jacob at the end of his life when he pronounces his blessing on his many sons. Jacob's blessing to his son Judah stands out. It links this branch of Israel's family tree, Judah's branch, with the previous promises about kings and also with the earliest expectations of a righteous ruler who will have victory over Satan. Jacob says this, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." And this is a moment in Scripture where we get more clarity about the one who will wield the scepter of righteousness. Readers now know, not only is he to be a human king, son of the woman, but he'll be a Jew from Abraham's family line, specifically a descendant of Judah. And as we heard in Joseph's story, his scepter stands for both judgment and mercy. It will still be many years before a king arises to lead Israel, but the idea of kingship is not forgotten through the long years of wilderness wanderings, the conquest of Canaan, and the time of the judges. All of these come before the kings. And in fact, woven into the law that Moses writes down for future generations, there are some specific instructions for all the kings that they figure are coming later on, so that they'll be careful to exercise their power or wield their scepter in all righteousness. Moses writes this, "When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then you say, 'I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me,' you may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that he may not turn aside from the commandment." So even before the monarchy begins, this is the standard that God sets for the future royal rulers of his people. They're supposed to be righteous and godly, humble and obedient, and most of all, saturated with his word. However, when the first king finally emerges on the scene for the nation of Israel, he ends up being a disappointment to everybody. Saul is disobedient to God, self-serving and unstable, and he's the first example of what kings should not be like. And actually, Saul's negative example of royal rule makes King David's initially faithful reign shine all the more brightly. So David is said to be a man after God's own heart, and it's on this bright model of faithfulness and righteousness that a new promise of a special future king called the Messiah is built. Now, sometimes the Messiah is even referred to as David himself returning to vindicate Israel, but this expected figure, it's the Christ that we read about so much in the New Testament. So just make a mental note that Christ and Messiah language and ideas date from the time of David, because the Messiah figure is modeled on David. And it is when David is at his best that his reign most resembles the righteous rule of the coming one. Now, the Psalms which were written by David and by others during the time of the kings. They're rich with messianic messages, and with their poetic imagery, the Psalms make much of the figure of the scepter, which represents the power and authority of the good king. So again, Psalm 45 that we saw in Hebrews. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of righteousness. And we remember how that psalm goes into a messianic view of the Son of God. Then Psalm 60 reminds us of the connection with Judah, who was David's direct ancestor. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim is my helmet, Judah is my scepter. And some of the messianic psalms, like Psalm 110, visualize the coming king. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, rule in the midst of your enemies. Now, regrettably, even David ultimately uses his kingly status for great evil. With the power and authority symbolized by that royal scepter, he commandeers a friend's wife, manipulates that friend's military assignments, and eventually gives the order that leads to that friend's murder. So when all is said and done, even the great King David cannot deliver on the promised scepter of righteousness. Nor do the rest of Israel's kings fare any better. Solomon's many intimate liaisons lead to his theological corruption, and his son Rehoboam, his pride leads to the loss of about two-thirds of the kingdom to a rival. That means that for the majority of time when there were kings in Israel, the kingdom was split, not whole and healthy. So as you read in the books of the kings and in the writing prophets, the portrait of the monarchy of the northern kingdom, which they called Israel, it was a bleak one. And then the southern kingdom, Judah, it didn't end up much better. And so during this time, the longing for a Messiah who will restore righteous rule grows more poignant as the prophets yearn for a day when the corruption of their own kings is replaced by a special ruler who can finally get it right. So, for example, Isaiah dreams of a day when a king will reign in righteousness and princes will rule in justice. Each will be like a hiding place from the wind, a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry place and the shade of a great rock in a weary land. You can hear the yearning in those poetic images. And then here's a familiar expression of longing for a righteous king from Zechariah. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. And remember what he's imagining. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. So these are just some examples of the prophetic longing for the good king towards the end of the reign of Israel's kings. Now, remember the scepter in Esther's story that I mentioned in the beginning. So the legendary reputation of that scepter emphasized that king's power to destroy lives and to save them. And Esther risked the wrath of that king to save her people. And that is a brave and exciting tale, but notice she was only put into that situation by the apostasy of the kings of her own nation, Israel. So when we read Esther's story, and also Daniel's and Nehemiah's, we're in the midst of the exile. That's when the people of Israel have been deported to foreign lands by conquering empires that God actually used to judge the nation of Israel. So, keeping in mind the age-old promise of that victorious, righteous ruler that we've painted up here, the one who would come from Abraham's and Judah's and David's family lines, it's painfully ironic that in the biblical account, the most merciful, faithful, and saving kings during this period are all foreigners. There's Xerxes, the Assyrian king, who grants Esther the salvation of her people. Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, whose bout of madness ends in a decree that all his subjects should worship the god of Daniel. And Cyrus, king of Persia, who directed the project to return Nehemiah and all of his friends to rebuild the walls and their temple. Ultimately, the promised Messiah won't look much like the kings of the Messiah's own nation. He's going to look and behave more like these outsider kings who extended their scepters, literally and figuratively, to bless God's people. Now, on our timeline, we have just reached the end of the Old Testament, and we've built up a picture of a kingly figure who's yet to come and whose scepter represents divine authority and righteous rule. And in our Bibles, sometimes we only have one thin page between the Old Testament and the New, but that thin page represents about 400 years of human history. And so during that intertestamental period, empires rise and fall, the Jews repopulate their land, sometimes they even have the upper hand in controlling it. And also during this time, expectation grows abundantly about the coming Messiah. Surely he will be powerful enough to throw off the yoke of the oppressors and restore the throne to Israel. Well then, turn the corner, turn the page, and enter Jesus into the picture. Son of man, son of Abraham, son of Judah, son of David, son of God, and all those other things that we wrote about up there. I'm going to assume you're familiar with the swirl of kingly language surrounding Jesus. There's a mix of popular speculation and truth in the gospel accounts, and the proclamation of his kingdom in the book of Acts, and deep theological analysis of his kingship in the epistles. And you can think of the power and authority represented by the royal scepter when you read words like these: the kingdom of God is at hand, or my kingdom is not of this world, or your kingdom come, your will be done. So Jesus, the humble king who speaks these words, has come. And he is the one to whom all power and authority are given. And remember, that's authority to judge as well as to pardon. Because in order to make all the good things come true, the divinely appointed king must deal with his enemies in strength and his people with compassion. So again, in the words of Hebrews, echoing Psalm 45, the scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Both compassion and judgment are the prerogative of the one who wields the scepter of righteousness. We have to wrap it up, but we can't stop without talking about our part in the story of the scepter of righteousness. In his letter to the Colossians, Paul writes a line worthy of every happily ever after fairy tale. He says this: God has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And this is the ultimate end point of all the longings, all the promises, all the foreshadowing by the good rulers, and even all the devastation wrought by corrupt kings throughout human history. We've traveled a long way from the garden in Genesis, but this complex story has always been leading back to the restoration of dominion by God's representatives on planet Earth. And that's us. We enter the kingdom through King Jesus, and part of the restoration of our relationship with God is this promise that one day we will reign with him. Proper human dominion will one day be restored on planet Earth. And we can think about this when we read this hymn in Revelation. And they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." So that is the story about the king, and about those of us who have become citizens of his kingdom of righteousness. And we praise God for his righteous reign and for working out the details of his plan so elegantly. And this is really the point of paying attention to this big picture redemptive history thing, because our God is a God who arranges every intricate detail just so in order to carry out his will. So rehearsing that biblical story of his deliberate planfulness through the ages should lead us to praise and trust him as he manages the many details of our own stories today. I'm going to end with a question and a recommendation for you. So as we ran through this biblical timeline in this brief talk, would you say that you were familiar with all the different periods of biblical history that I mentioned here? Because if you're not, this is something you can learn over time. And there are some resources available to you just from the Women in the Word website. You have many talks and articles that rehearse this story. This talk will be on there soon. And these will help you develop an awareness of the historical context of anything you read in the Bible. So this weekend, as you're studying and listening to each other, listen for the elements of the history of redemption that I've mentioned here. Use that timeline that I've given you this weekend and whenever you dip into the Word to help you find your place in the story. So now I commend you to the King of Kings, who brought you out of darkness and into his kingdom of marvelous light. May you grow in your joyful and reasonable reading of the Word today and in all your tomorrows. Enjoy this workshop.